The In Radio Podcast with Dom Chambers.
In Radio. Hello and welcome to the In Radio Podcast, and something of a re-engagement is going on here, as I'm afraid this podcast has been rather neglected of late. And just as it's feeling lonely, isolated and rather unloved, here I am slamming all my energies back into it and reminding myself as to why I started this in the first place. And those themes, by the way, do underwrite my work here today. Let me tell you a thing. Well, now, right at the start of the lockdown in January 2021, I started to write a book. What happened was, one of the trustees from the charity that I started in 2017, which, if I haven't mentioned before, is about the impacts of audio communications and media training on individuals, communities, and society. Well, now, Lucy said to me, "You've got to tell this story. It's a great story of how this charity came about, what inspires it, and what's driving it forward." So I sat down one Sunday afternoon in January, and I thought, I'll knock out a little blog about the matter. And I soon realized, within about 5 minutes, that what I was embarking on was writing a book. And I very much hope to bring it to you in audio form before publication later in the year. But inevitably, in such a book, I was going to explore the importance of radio to me personally. And that took me back to that awkward time that pretty well everybody has in that transition from childhood to adulthood. In my case, I'm thinking of when I was 13, I was being bullied at school. I was feeling lonely, isolated, alienated, and utterly miserable, quite frankly. Now, I don't want to tug the heartstrings today. Well, maybe I do, but best leave that until the actual book comes out. The point I'm making here is that in this miserable state, the one thing I had was a small radio transistor and the whole Radio 1 family. I was a teenager in the early 1980s. So that takes us back to the glory days of Radio 1, when those big shows attracted audiences of millions. But for all that, for the listener, it is that close and intimate relationship between the listener and the radio station of their choice, and those trusted voices that come with that. And as I was writing about all this, it was particularly the summer of 1980 I was thinking of. And the one thing I looked forward to every day was the Radio 1 Roadshow. I mentioned this to my friend and colleague at Summer Valley FM, Rob Bailey, a long-standing employee of the BBC, and he mentioned that he knew Johnny Beeling. Well, the name Johnny Beeling comes to me, particularly as somebody who's developed a career in radio, as the ultimate god of radio management, I suppose. And I thought, wouldn't it be a wonderful idea to have a chat with Johnny to find out how that era of Radio 1 that was so important to me personally and therefore was important to millions of other kids and young people of my age group, perhaps up to 10 years older and even a little bit younger, who remember the sounds of Radio 1 in the 70s and 80s. Johnny was, of course, behind the great Radio 1 Roadshow, and that is the starting point of our conversation. Incidentally, at about this time, Rob Bailey also had a recorded conversation with Johnny, and I've taken a really nice little bit of that and inserted it into my conversation as Johnny is talking about the importance in modern times of local radio, of community-orientated local radio. And that kind of ties in nicely with where his career, still going in his 80s, and Rob's, who's also retired, has ended up. So we'll enjoy that a little bit later. Meanwhile, if these sounds mean anything to you, you are in the right place for quality conversation.
Across the UK, for you and me, Britain's favourite Radio 1. The Radio 1 Roadshow. Radio 1 on the road.
Radio 1 Roadshow, bits and pieces.
I'm the pieces, bits and pieces.
Thursday, a beautiful, beautiful day. The roadshow's moved on from Butte, and we are in a delightful place. We're at New Quay. We're on the beach.
The roadshow, at its simplest, was a man playing records in a box on the beach. But such was the popularity of the presenters, people like Nell Evans, Tony and Davy Travis and what have you, that they attracted enormous crowds. I mean, towards the end of the roadshow, there was something like we estimated about 500,000 people a year seeing it as it travelled to the beaches of the UK. And I should explain, I started it because I used to take my family camping in France, and we were down at one of these campsites one evening, and I saw everybody trekking off after supper with their little aluminium chairs. And I thought, well, I'll follow them and see what's happening. And it was, I can't remember, either Radio Monte Carlo or Europe Number One or someone, had this Pantechnicon with a side that opened, and they had a sort of entertainment families, a bit like sort of Sunday night at the Palladium. They had variety acts and bands playing and what have you. And I came back fired with the idea this would be a great way to promote Radio 1 if we could do it around the seaside resorts of the UK. We originally had a program called Radio 1 Club. This was a lunchtime program in the Paris cinema in Lower Regent Street, where people could get a club membership and turn up, and they could see Keith Fordyce presenting an hour on records with interviews with popular groups who were in town and wanted to promote their record. And kids could dance in the stage part of the studio. And so that became popular. It was broadcast at lunchtime. And eventually I hit on the idea of using the BBC's studio complexes in Bristol, Birmingham, Glasgow, Belfast, and linking the two up. So the studio in the Paris studio in London was joined by another presenter who was broadcasting live from Birmingham or Cardiff or Swansea. And this took off. It was so popular that kids started to play truant in the afternoon, and we had to shut it down after about 4 years. And I hit on this idea of the Radio 1 Roadshow as a replacement for the Radio 1 Club. And the first year we started it, which was 1973, we used to broadcast it two times. And we started in Newquay. And I remember the audience who'd been watching us with this roadshow had been drinking the local cider. So they were pretty happy by the time we went on the air at 5 o'clock. And it was good-natured chanting and chai-hiking from the crowd. So the following year, we changed it back to lunchtimes.
When the roadshows proved so popular, they were clearly a fantastic live show for those attending. But how did you square that off with the needs of a radio audience? How did you kind of ensure that the listener was still included in what was going on with all these crowds and DJs and show performance?
It was down to the talents of the presenters, actually. They could describe what was going on because of the various sort of stunts and gags and gimmicks and comic acts that were taking place. And we also had live bands playing as well, which was one of the reasons it came to an end after it ran for about 27 years, which is not a bad run for a travel show. But it became bigger and bigger. It was a victim of its own success because we had, by then we'd got stereo broadcasting, so we had to have a van with a satellite dish. We had to put in a screen and extra public address equipment so people at the back could hear because the crowds were so big. So it was a difficult procedure, but the DJs became very skilled at it, and usually would have a second disc jockey there that would help by describing what was going on. But they were original, creative, innovative presenters who had a job to do, and they did it very, very well. But they were also as popular as some of the stars they were introducing. Crowds were so huge, we'd have to have police escorts getting them in and out. And they would stick around afterwards and sign autographs for perhaps 2 hours after the show had finished.
What is it about Radio 1 in those days? And I'm speaking now with somebody who has a memory of being, you know, like all teenagers, lonely at times. And the loneliness was broken up by having the transistor on, having the roadshow on, having those familiar voices, and feeling, I suppose, part of a family and part of a wider community than the loneliness of your immediate situation. What was it about Radio 1 in those days that kind of generated what you might describe as a family atmosphere?
Well, I think one of the reasons why the roadshow was so successful was that I didn't want the audience to think of us as that station down there in London. The idea was that in 6 or 7 weeks of the summer holidays, we would travel the entire coastline of the UK, including Northern Ireland, and we could always start the shows earlier in Northern Ireland because they broke up sooner for their summer holidays. So we'd do Northern Ireland, then round to Scotland. So people from all over the country got to see these people that they enjoyed listening to on the radio.
How did you find sort of becoming the boss at Radio 1 in the mid-80s?
How did I find it? Well, it's a big thrill. It was a big challenge, too. I mean, I had ideas about what I wanted. And, of course, people above the top of the BBC also had ideas about what they wanted, and we didn't always agree. Certainly, I didn't agree with John Burt about a lot of the changes that he made. It's a balancing act. I mean, it still is to this day, I think. There's always the pressure on from people at the top who want the BBC to be very worthy and worthwhile. David Hatch's attitude when he was managing it was that we should serve all people who are paying the licence fee, and young people pay a licence fee. They're as entitled to their popular music as the Radio 3 listeners or the Radio 4 listeners. So we should give value for money. And so get the biggest audience you can, which is what we did. And it was audiences by day and reputation by night. So after 5 o'clock in the evening, we would tend to go into more specialised areas of programming.
It was, I would suggest, a time of great confidence for the BBC. I mean, there was very little competition, and it seemed very confident in what it was doing. And I think quite experimental. Is that the way you would see it?
Well, I think that's one of the things we should say is the reason why it was so successful too, apart from the appeal of the disc jockeys, was the fact there was no competition. It wasn't until the 70s when independent local radio started that our audiences started to decline and people found that there were other ways of getting popular music than by listening to Radio 1. With this limitation on the number of records it could play and the fact that it wasn't on the air 24 hours a day.
One of the things I remember as a young listener in the 80s was being aware that social action was kind of coming into radio. And as somebody who runs a charity now, which is very focused on how we use the media to achieve social change and to shore up the fabric of community life, I can see that there was some influence coming out of this. Was that a decision taken by you personally to introduce a more social action approach to some of the broadcasting?
Yes. There was a lot of that. I mean, John Burt once said, I can't hear any difference between Radio 1 and Capital Radio. And I said, well, you must be deaf, because we have social action broadcasting, which I was very supportive of. We were doing programs to encourage people with problems with drugs and money and all the other problems that go with living today. We do more live sessions because we had multi-track recording and we were able to get better and better bands and better sounds of recording. We had more legal time. Live concerts. You know, I realised the price of tickets for live concerts was beyond the pocket of a lot of young people. So we deliberately set out to do more live concerts every week. And we had a huge coverage of live concerts by people like Michael Jackson and Madonna and people like this.
Live Aid was
one of the biggest things we did.
Yeah. Well, tell me about Live Aid, because it's so iconic of the mid-80s, isn't it?
Well, there was great difficulty about that, because when we first started negotiating with Bob Geldof to do the broadcasting rights, he obviously wanted to appeal for money for the starving in Ethiopia. And he said, if I can't appeal for money, there's no effing way you're going to get the rights to broadcast the show. Put it there, as it simplest. And that was a big political decision for the BBC, because they had not allowed their airwaves to be used for appeals. And it had to go to Michael Checkland, who's Deputy Director General. Alan Yentob went on behalf of BBC Two, and I went on behalf of Radio One. And he had to put it to the board before we got agreement. That was one of the things. And then we had to get the rights to do it from all the different countries and all the permissions from the artists to broadcast live. And the division between BBC Television and BBC Radio, traditionally television have always done their own sound, and they didn't like the idea that Radio 1 would do the sound feed and they would do the picture feed. and then the two would merge. So that was another political battle out to be sorted out between unions and what have you. So those were all things that were going on in the background. But it was probably one of the biggest live concerts there ever was or ever will be, I think. 75,000 people, perfect summer weather. Everything went very well, except towards the end, Paul McCartney was topping the bill, and the lights went down, and they started to play the piano intro, and the piano intro went on and on and on and on. And I think it was about 1 minute, 45 seconds, because we had lost the microphone for Paul McCartney. And even to this day, if you buy the DVD recording of the concert, you'll find that that vocal is there, because Jeff Griffin, who was producing, had quite illegally multi-tracked it and recorded it, and Paul McCartney offered to come back in and relayed in the vocal in the right place. So it was rather good, wasn't it?
Fantastic story. I suppose in this period that we're talking about, Radio 1 had gone from the fresh, the new, the exciting, that whole sort of the launch of the DJ superstar in the late 60s. And by the 80s, whilst the audiences were still big, it had become much more establishment. I think Radio 1 did the, or Steve Wright did the 40th birthday party of the Prince of Wales.
We did. I remember doing that. It was in Birmingham somewhere. I can't remember where in Birmingham. I had tried, you know, one of the things I wanted was to get away from the swashy and nicey image and introduce some new presenters who were actually more interested in the music than in presenting themselves. And people like Mark Goodyear, Nicky Campbell, Simon Mayo. I think they're all people I've brought in who are, well, they're still broadcasting today. And not Mark Goodyear, I think, but all the others are. Yeah, I think that was reason to make Radio 1 sound a bit more grown up. I remember Roger Scott summed it up. He said, "I can't wait to get into the studio to share this great piece of music that I found with the audience." And he was interested in selling the music rather than selling himself. And that was something I was keen on. I remember putting up a notice in the studio one day saying, "One thought, one link" as an instruction. Somebody else wrote underneath it, "You'll be lucky." Think about that.
Yeah.
I was also keen on getting more women broadcasters. You know, we didn't have, we had Annie Nightingale. She was the token woman, but it was always looked on as, apart from Jean Metcalf, going back to the days of Family Favourites, there hadn't been many lady presenters. And I brought in Janice Long, Ranking Miss P, who did the reggae show, Sybil Roscoe, who was on Newsbeat. Well, that was another thing that I increased. I put Newsbeat up to half an hour in the evenings because more people heard their news on Radio 1 than any other BBC network, because by virtue of the fact that our audiences were so large. Sybil Roscoe, Liz Kershaw. Yeah, they were all girls that I brought on. Claire Sturgis, she was one of the secretaries in Radio 1, who actually became quite a good presenter.
I remember she was, I think, producing Simon Bates at one point, and then, of course,
yes, she was.
The great Tommy Vance.
Yes.
If you were into rock music, Radio 1 was your only destination. Fluff
it
Freeman,
was.
Of course, and Tommy Vance.
Not off. I had a plan, you know, when I was negotiating my way out of Radio 1, and it was probably right that I went, because I'd been there since it started, and 25 years later, the audience was growing older, and I was growing older. I said to Liz Forgan, who by then had taken over from David Hatch as managing director of Radio, "Let me go and run Radio 2, because we can take all these older disc jockeys like Steve Wright and Simon Bates and David Travis and so on, Alan Freeman, Bob Harris, Gary Davis, onto Radio 2 and change the music policy on Radio 2 gradually, and use the power of the BBC's appeal to switch the audience away, and then you can relaunch Radio 1 as a young, sharp, competitive network." And they said, "We don't want to do that. It disadvantages the older listeners who listen to Radio 2. I said, "But the BBC local radio has a median age of 60+, so they can listen to BBC local radio. Radio 2 can become the new look Radio 1. And then Radio 1 can be young and sharp and appealing to the kids." And she said, "Well, we don't want to do that." So I left him eventually. Not on bad terms, but I thought it was a good idea and the way things should have gone. And it took another 10 years before Jim Moyer took over as boss of Radio 2 and did more or less exactly what I described. And Steve Wright's still there. Bob Harris, he's off sick, but he's still there. Alan Freeman's gone. Gary Davis is there. Sam Bates is gone. There we are.
It takes time, doesn't it? But it's logical, isn't it, that when you're younger, you're with one station and then the presenters and the audience moves to the different network. And in fact, I think Radio 2 has been the most listened to light entertainment station in the country for many years now. And perhaps it's because of those audiences that built their loyalty to the BBC in the 80s, 70s and 80s, who are now still with the BBC in the form of BBC Radio 2.
Yeah, but they've lost their way in a sense that they seem to have got a philosophy that if you're a big name on television, you'd be a big name in radio and not necessarily a lover of music. And I think that's a shame. And I think they've lost out because of that.
One of the things that occurs to me when you look at Top of the Pops now, and obviously cross-pollination between Radio 1 and Top of the Pops in the 80s was huge. You look at it and you see these great radio names not always doing a tremendous job, actually, in front of the TV camera. I wondered, you know, what you think is the difference between a radio presenter and a TV presenter?
Well, I think the best broadcasters about music are those who know about music and love about it and don't care what they look like and are not interested in pushing a false personality. The people who are truly successful, Nell Evans, Jimmy Young, Terry Wogan, Tony Blackburn, because off the microphone they are exactly the same as they are on the air. And so they're genuine people who love the music and are happy to talk about it. Whereas on television it's a different skill and a different type of entertainment. I always thought Kenny Everett was probably one of the greatest disc jockeys ever in the whole history of broadcasting. And I thought the persona that he adopted on television wasn't the Kenny Everett that I knew. It wasn't the real Kenny Everett. It was an act. And I thought it wasn't the real, genuine Kenny that we heard, because Kenny Everett on the radio was so creative and inventive. He was a very, very good technical operator, but he also had a perfect pitch. And he discovered the skill of multi-tracking and bouncing his voice back and forwards. And he was truly creative. He made some of the early jingles when we first launched Radio 1. And he would take some little piece of non-copyright music and write words to it and then track four tracks of harmony into singing the words. And that was all part of his creative talent. Somebody like Adrian Just modelled his skills on the old Jack Jackson, if you can remember that far back, using little clips of comedy records and putting it all together. So I say radio presenters have got to love the music and be creative in the way in which they present it to the audience.
Hearing you talk about your time as a boss at Radio 1, bringing on female creative talent on the airwaves, bringing on the social action, increasing the news, doing some really important developments. But the history book seems to have consigned that period to the smashy and nicey comedy sketches that came out in the 1990s. And then there was talk about dinosaurs and, you know, Simon Bates and so forth. And then it sort of builds to this great tension when you leave, Matthew Bannister arrives. They make a tremendous documentary, which I only watched the other day for the nth time, Blood on the Carpet. And it was all about change. Is that how you look back on this? It seems to me that you were introducing a lot of changes that became, you know, really important to the development of Radio 1. But how do you look at that period of your time coming to an end and other people having a go?
Well, I think it was right to make the change, but I think the change should have been the way in which I suggested. You know, the BBC has got an enormously powerful voice and it could have persuaded people to, those older people, to switch to Radio 2, which had good FM coverage and played the sort of music that Radio 2 is playing now.
You were talking earlier in our conversation about the talent of the people who were on the airwaves, getting those big audiences. And you mentioned that Chris Moyles was kind of last of a breed. You know, what do you think happened in the marketplace? What happened to the audience needs that required perhaps a different approach to presenting?
Well, there's an education, as you'll appreciate. There isn't a training ground now. I thought, until recently, that the BBC local radio was the last bastion of decent local broadcasting, and sad that the current director general and management are sort of cutting their budget, so they're doing this. They seem to think that by playing one or two records by young artists, they will get the young people to listen to the radio. And it's a different generation, Dom. I think life has changed enormously since the 60s and 70s. And I think people these days, I'll take my own grandchildren as well, 21, 18 and 16, they don't listen to the radio very much. They listen to Spotify and they pick up these things from Geezer, is it? I don't even know. Or they're into playing games or looking at their phone or watching their iPads and so on. So there isn't the appeal of radio anymore. And there isn't the training ground in that. I'm hopeful that this sort of new chain of DAB-based low-power community stations might encourage young people to take it up. And if it isn't just the music, it's the presenters as well.
What do you think about the development of the community approach to broadcasting? This came out of, I think, a New Labour initiative, but I don't think anybody involved with the creation of community radio 15 years ago could have predicted that here we are in 2021 and there's over 300 licences broadcasting across the UK. So it's clearly having an impact, isn't it?
It's amazing, and I think it's very good. I mean, I was living up in Skipton in Yorkshire. We applied to run one. We got outmaneuvered by local commercial interests. We didn't want people who knew too much about it, I think, like community radio. But I thought the idea was that, you know, we would train up the young people in Skipton to become good presenters. And I thought it was a man called John Evington who was with me on the bid, and Stuart Clarkson, who reached the news on Radio 5 Live. We thought between us as professionals we could actually train young people to get on and do the job in a way in which they could benefit from our experience. So I'm hopeful that people like you, who are in a strong position in community radio, can encourage talent, because the big organisations that have taken over independent local radio seem more interested in money, and here is and that was, and here's an advert, and here's a jingle, and let's get on with it, let's cut the amount of local news we do, let's just make money, and I think that's sad.
I think young people at the moment, if they do have a community station or even a hospital radio station, one of the volunteer orientated radio stations near them, are as enthusiastic as any previous generation. I think you're right, though. I'm not sure that young people are necessarily listening to the radio, but they want to make it. And I think that's quite encouraging.
It is. It is good. And in our day, it was only hospital radio, wasn't it? Radio Lollipop, I think. Peter Powell was very much behind. And you have other places to learn, except on local community radio nowadays. I mean, BBC local radio is cutting all its shows to 4 hours, from what I can see, and getting rid of more experienced presenters. So it's all very sad. So let's hope that community radio exposes and discovers some new talent.
I think there is an appetite for locally made audio, and these days we don't just talk about radio. We obviously talk about audio with the whole sort of podcasting approach to of the industry, which has been enormously impactful. I think there is an appetite, and probably a developing appetite, in the face of how commercial radio has homogenized over the years, and not least more intensely in the last 2 or 3 years. And I'm picking up that you know, there's a real appetite to not only make, but to engage with local audio and radio, and that gives me great confidence that there is a future for local radio in this country.
Well, I'm very pleased to hear that. I mean, that's the most encouraging news I've heard for a long time.
In Radio, conversations with Dom Chambers.
Radio Today. Now, just as we've reached a point in our conversation when we're talking about the, or at least I'm talking mainly about the importance of local radio, let's take time out from my conversation with Johnny, because this is the right place to hear a lovely exchange between Rob Bailey and Johnny, both retired from the main activities of their career, but still very engaged in radio. And we've reached the point where they're getting a little philosophical.
It's interesting that you started broadcasting over there in Aden in the early 60s, but you've come full circle. You're now broadcasting again, like me. We're retired now, we don't mind admitting it, but radio is the first love, and here I am volunteering.
Us old chaps have got to find something to do in our old age, haven't we?
I know. It's sort of keeping the grey matter going. But
the wheel has turned full circle.
Yeah.
The great Mark Tully once told me that. I worked with him in India for a while, and he was saying the Indians have a theory that life is circular and you finish up doing what you started. That's certainly true in my case.
That is very interesting, yes. Well, it does. I think you just, in the end, it's not to do with money now. It's what you want to do with your hours, with your time. And you're doing a show on a serenade radio, big band stuff. And here I am on a nice community station. And it's lovely. Get you out of the house.
Community radio doing a great job keeping the locals entertained and informed.
Talking about the future of radio, and you think community radio has its place, don't you? It's all changed a bit in radio.
It has a very important place these days because, you know, all the commercial stations seem to be merging under three or four big groups, doing less and less local stuff. The BBC seems to have lost its way and it's pandering for a youth audience and alienating all the older people who listen to local radio. And they're being starved of money, so they can't do as much local news as they might do. So I think community radio has an increasing part to play. And Ofcom, as you probably know, have licensed a lot more low-power DAB stations in towns up and down the country. So we shall see more and more of it in the next few years.
And things like the coronavirus, which puts a lot of people at home over the last lockdown year, people have been using the radio a lot more. I think it's anecdotal or actual, but we know that we have a lot of feedback from listeners saying they're like a friend to you. You know, the radio station is your friend when you might not be able to go out and so on.
That's certainly true of our station, Serenade, you know, which appeals. It plays the sort of music for older people that no other radio station caters for, and we get enormous number of letters of praise and support. Sing something simple and music while you work and all those things. We play on Serenade and it's very much appreciated by the older people who are alone.
It is interesting hearing Johnny and Rob talk about the increasing importance of local radio, which, as Johnny was just saying there, seems to have found a role for identifying specialist audience sectors and niche sectors, as well as the broader-based local communities. All this was really the province of the BBC for many decades. And so, inevitably, while I had the attention of one of the great BBC radio stalwarts, our conversation found its way round to the future of the corporation.
Yes, I think it's quite interesting to think about the whole future of the BBC, isn't it, under the way it's currently funded and the licence fee and the whole thing. I can see a situation where they'll only be left with Radio 4 and probably local radio.
If we were to make an assumption that perhaps we have a government in place that is going to question the validity of people paying the licence fee and is going to explore lead up to the next charter, which is still a way ahead, but you know, I can see the discussion starting now for the next charter, and it's unlikely, I think, to be just a rollover situation that we've seen for the last 30-odd years. I mean, if the licence fee was to go, how do you see that the BBC would pay for local radio? Would they just have to become commercial and free from the restrictions they currently operate as public broadcasters?
As a subscription might be a one-way forward, or following the American NPR route, which we use in Serenade Radio. We have no commercials on Serenade Radio, and yet it's sustained by more efficient ways of working and by public subscription. People genuinely like the fact that we do something different from any other radio station. We play music that isn't catered for by other radio stations, and which does appeal to that audience, to the over 65, I guess, is the sort of age group that we look at. So I suppose the answer to your question is by supplying something that is demanded by the public who are prepared to pay for it. I reckon the BBC, if we look I shan't be alive in 20 years' time, but I think we might see a situation where it's supplying programs as a program maker for other platforms to broadcast. Maybe keeping Radio 4 on perhaps one television network. And as you say, maybe a chain of local radio stations which are helping these community stations by providing service to them.
So in the current landscape, I mean, do you think there's a future for all this, or do you think we're on a sort of long tapering to extinction of the radio industry?
I think it's on a downhill slope. I think the only hope is in localness. I mean, obviously there is money to be made by these big organisations, but they're just narrow casting, aren't they? They're getting more and more specialised networks of one particular type of music on a tight playlist with not much room for inventiveness in terms of presentation.
I agree. I think it's all about the local, because as we, you know, forever thinking about ourselves as a globe and wider worlds, I think the focus back onto, and perhaps the pandemic has really shown this, that...
Well, that's also the thing. You could look at what's happening in the local press. They're suffering a decline too, aren't they? So maybe you can get more back from... my wife's brought me a cup of coffee. That's good, isn't it? Thank you, my love. Yes, I was saying local radio is... Local newspapers are in decline, so... You've got to hope that people will get their local news from community stations.
I think that's where the future is, and it's very encouraging to hear you think that as well. As we begin to think about wrapping up this fascinating conversation, I've learned so much. It's been brilliant. Have you got, a couple of anecdotes about those times when back in Radio 1, audience of millions, teenagers like myself, hanging on the every word of Simon Bates and building sites, stopping activity for Simon Bates's R tune and Paul Gambaccini doing his amazing band profiles and Gary's bit in the middle and all those days, Steve Wright in the afternoon and his wonderful characters and great breakfast shows. What are your favourite memories of that period?
I'll give you my most unfavourite memory, which was the day when the Bass City Rollers came to Mallory Park. I nearly lost my job. I mean, we had the roadshow was incredibly popular, as you heard earlier, but we had started to do sort of big events at motor racing circuits. It was an appeal between motor racing, because Noel Edmonds was very into it, and Mike Smith was very into it, and I was very into it. There was an appeal between motor racing and the road show. And so we got together with circuit owners and we did two big shows down at Brands Hatch, Radio 1 Thunday, in which we did disc jockeys racing against each other in Ford Escorts. We did road show live broadcasts. We had personal appearances by pop groups and what have you. So the owner of Brands Hatch also owned Mallory Park in the Midlands. And we said we'll put up a Radio 1 fun day at Mallory Park. As the top of the bill, we'll have the Bay City Rollers turning up. Well, the local police had totally underestimated the appeal that we had. And by midday, we had done a roadshow in the morning and we were going to do a second one in the afternoon with racing in between around the circuit. And I should explain the circuit is... there's a lake in the middle and then the racetrack runs around the outside and then outside that over the observers and viewers. And by midday, we had got 40,000 people into the circuit and 20,000 people stuck in all the roads around outside Mallory Park. And the chief constable was there and he had the owner of the circuit, John Webb and myself, and he gave us a dressing down. He said, "You chaps, you don't know, look, totally irresponsible." I said, "Well, sir, you should have put more police on duty." "Well, we didn't realise it was going to be like this. And when you bring these Bay City Roller chappies in, there's going to be a riot." And I said, "Well, that's all right. I'll cancel them. They're coming in by helicopter. I'll know the helicopter pilot and I'll call them up." And he said, "If you cancel them, there'll be a riot too. We don't know what we're going to do." So we compromised. We had in this lake in the middle of Ram, which the race circuit ran, there was a hospitality tent which we use as a green room. I said, "We will land them on the island in the middle of the lake." But as the helicopter came in, regardless of the fact there was a race going on with cars going around the circuit at 100 miles an hour, all these fans of the Bay City Rollers ran across the track, straight into the lake, into the water, trying to get to this island on which the Rollers were landing. And I was just horrified. I mean, obviously the race was stopped and luckily nobody was hit by the cars. But then we were feared they might get drowned in the water. So my wife and I were dragging them out of the water and stretching them out. And you'd never see anything like it. It's like a scene out of Vietnam. In the closing days, of the Americans leaving. I could see my coolie disappearing. Somebody gets drowned. It's one of the worst days of my life. And I think it was written up in every single national newspaper the next day. This so-called Radio 1 Fun Day. And I think all we had was a couple of sprained ankles or something like that.
I remember John Peel spoke about this. And he describes the chaos much like you've just described. Although, obviously, in your case, it comes with the responsibility of you being in charge. But he said in the middle of all this, and for reasons I don't understand, and frankly, I don't want to understand, Tony Blackburn was being driven up and down the lagoon by a womble.
By the wombles. It was Shawaddy Waddy. They were doing water skiing in the lake. So another demonstration of our versatility. And the Wombles were there from Mike Batt's organisation. Yes, it was quite something.
What about friendships? I mean, there was a lot of big personalities. Did you make good friends?
Yes, I'm still very friendly with Keith Skews, funny enough. Keith has just finished in. He's been dumped by, they call it North East Radio. It's Radio Norfolk and Suffolk and three of Eastern Counties, I think they call it. And poor chappy just done 500 programmes. He finished his 500th programme because he's 80. And he's got the wrong audience. He's been dumped. But a lot of others.
And what about those big personalities from that era? Are you still in touch with Simon Bates, Steve Wright and so forth?
Steve Wright, I haven't seen for a couple of years. Kid Jensen, I see. Kid's sadly got Parkinson's disease, but he doesn't live too far from me. Not many of the old ones now. David Hamilton. David lives in the same village as me, here in Sussex.
And that is where we will draw a close to this conversation, perhaps with thoughts of those two meeting down the local for a fireside chat about how it all used to be. And I have so enjoyed chatting with Johnny and getting a greater understanding of what lay behind the Radio 1 that I and so many of us knew and loved and grew up with, if indeed we ever grew up, because those voices we were listening to sure as heck weren't grown up, and they took pride in that. We all had a lot of fun, listener, presenter, caught up in a mad, zany world of pop sounds. That, as I stated at the start of this conversation, had so much therapeutic benefit. That's it for this edition of the In Radio podcast, but fear not, there's more coming very soon, and we'll avoid the radio silence of the last few months. Local Radio Day coming up on the 15th of October. Lots to talk about heading up to that annual event. I spent the summer out and about on the road exploring various models of local radio here in the UK. So some dedicated podcasts coming soon on that. Many thanks to Johnny Beeling for giving his time with such fascinating insights to this podcast. And also my gratitude to Rob Bailey for getting the whole thing going and allowing me to use some of his own recorded conversations. And I'll catch you back here very soon for more In Radio. In Radio.